Jew 2, Tales of the Mixed Multitude, is made possible through the generous support of the Auerbach Family Foundation and the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. I'm Rabbi Emily Cohen. Thanks for listening.
I have this really crazy party trick that I can break out, which is that I can tell people that my mom's a minister and my wife's a rabbi, and like, then see what happens. And that there's a lot behind that. You know, my parents were like interfaith pioneers in a lot of ways. You know, they raised us in the early 80s. It was a new thing to do. Now it's almost one in two people will cross religious lines to marry or be partnered with somebody. But then that was definitely not the case. So I feel like I have some lessons from what happened and also continue to try to figure out this story. So this is an opportunity to talk about it.
Isaac Luria is a philanthropic professional at the Nathan Cummings Foundation. He's also the co-founder of Beloved with his partner, Rabbi Sarah Luria.
Yeah, so Sarah and I were, like many of us, I think completely bereft after the 2016 election. It was necessary to recommit to our tradition in an open-hearted, grace-infused, deeply Jewish, embodied experience where people got to feel the security they might need at least for a little while in a home at a Shabbat dinner so that they could go out and be a part of a world that was increasingly challenging. And so Sarah and I moved in here. I mean, we raised just enough money to make it for 1 year of rent, had no money for anything else, and then people came and this became a thing. And what I hope is that it will be a part of what the history of American Jews did to respond to this particularly challenging moment.
I asked Isaac to share a little bit about Beloved, because that's where we were sitting when this interview took place. For the first time, I experimented with doing a live episode recording, so I interviewed both Isaac and Reverend Barbara Becker, our other guest for this episode, at the same time. A small group of audience members shared the space with us to witness the conversation, so if you hear some laughter or shuffling in the background, that's them. And as for those of you who are now wondering why I interviewed a reverend on a podcast that's about Jewish families, or at least about Jewish interfaith families, well, maybe this will explain it.
I am the mom of two Jewish sons. We have a Jewish home. I wouldn't even call it an interfaith home. I would call it a Jewish home. We're living on the Lower East Side in a community that's still largely Orthodox. We have a Shabbos elevator in our apartment building. And the apartment belonged to my husband's grandfather. So my kids are the fourth generation to live in that apartment and the fifth generation of that family to live in that neighborhood. So they, you know, walk around the world not understanding that, you know, the Jewish people are 2% of the U.S. population or 0.02% of the world population. They still haven't really encountered a world that sees them as different because they just see themselves as the majority where we live. So it's a pretty fascinating place.
I've lived in New York City for almost a year now, and it is indeed a pretty fascinating place. This is a good moment for me to give you a little insight as to how this particular episode came into being. I first met Reverend Barbara a few months ago, standing outside the Religious Life Center at NYU, the day after the attacks on the Muslim community in Christchurch. An interfaith coalition of clergy and laypeople had gathered just before the afternoon Juma prayer on a Friday to show the Muslim community support as they went into their prayer space. Barbara and I happened to be standing next to each other and got to talking, and I learned that she was a community minister for Judson Memorial Church, which Lab Shul, where I work, partners with often. We got coffee, and I was delighted to learn that in addition to being somebody who identifies as an interfaith minister with a Christian background, Reverend Barbara and her Jewish husband were raising two Jewish kids. Immediately, I thought of Isaac, whom I'd met at various points throughout my time in Brooklyn, and who I knew had a mother who was a minister and a wife who was a rabbi. I thought they'd be a great pair, both because of their shared mother-minister thing and for one other fact that I'll let you in on a little bit later in the episode. For a variety of reasons, Barbara and Isaac's stories are not the same, but they do run on parallel tracks, raising kids in homes with relatives that come from a variety of backgrounds, and yet still managing to do Jewish. And that's an interesting thing about New York. In this city, there's not nearly as much interfaith gatekeeping as there might be in other places. Even if one spot is closed to you because you have the wrong kind of parentage or had the wrong kind of conversion or both, there will be other spots, likely within a mile, that would welcome you with open arms. So for Barbara's two sons, there was never a question that there would be the option of Jewish community. But like many Jews who have two Jewish parents or no Jewish parents, Barbara's sons took to Judaism a little bit differently.
My older son, there were sort of no questions asked. He was going to have a bar mitzvah. He just loved it, like completely embraced like Jewish learning, the education. He just like couldn't love it anymore. And my younger son was like, if you make me do a bar mitzvah, I'm going to sue you because you're denying my, you know, religious liberties. And he's like a super intense kid. I don't think he would have liked religion in any, you know, faith tradition.
Right.
But that's,
equal opportunity.
Yeah,
suing.
Equal yeah. opportunity suing. I have learned from him. I learned the term the God wrestler. He really is like Jacob turning into Israel, just fighting like, you know, every step of the way to learn and to figure things out for himself. So it's been, it's an incredible experience parenting these two Jewish sons. I grew up in the Protestant churches of northern New Jersey. Both of my parents had relatives who were Dutch, and the most easy congregation for them was the Dutch Reformed Church. So in this little church across town from where I lived, I had a congregation that knew my parents and my grandparents. Some people still spoke Dutch. It's a relatively conservative branch of American Protestantism with deep roots in New York. Peter Stuyvesant, who New Yorkers are very familiar with, was a super strict Dutch reformer, and he would tax people who didn't go to church on Sundays. And, you know, he didn't like Catholics, he didn't like Jews, he didn't like anybody except for Dutch Reformed. So I wouldn't say my religious upbringing was that strict, but there were definitely roots in that tradition. But even more than that, I think I would say that the example of my parents was really the root of my religious interest. My mom sat every morning reading the Bible and then worked through a prayer chain of people in the church who needed help, were homebound or sick or in need. She spent probably about 2 hours of every day just being in a contemplative space, caring for people in that community. As much as my mom loved the Bible, my dad loved Henry David Thoreau. So Walden became like another Bible in our household. And my dad loved to be outside in nature. Like that's where he communed with the divine, if he would even call it that. I think we spent a lot of Sundays going to Sunday school and then going outside and hiking in the mountains. I really took in that connection between something way larger than ourselves that sometimes wasn't even tangible. Like that's where my feeling of God or the divine came from. My dad was a neurosurgeon, and he spent a lot of time donating services to hospitals, inner city hospitals that a lot of people didn't want to work in. So from him and from my mother, I had a really strong sense of being of service to other people.
My dad's Jewish and my mom's a Christian minister. They met at an anti-war rally at Yale where my mom was associate chaplain. I had a bris and a baptism, a confirmation and a bar mitzvah. My weekends were, you know, spent less at soccer and more at religious services. Friday night, sometimes Saturday morning, and then Sunday would be at church with my mom. I struggled a lot with feeling belonging in any one of those places.
Unfortunately, some of the people who should have been helping Isaac to find a sense of belonging were also the people who made him question it most.
You know, we went and met with the rabbi before the bar mitzvah, my dad and I, and she was like, yeah, so you're going to have to choose one day which religion you want to be. Which to a 12-year-old kid is like a ridiculous thing to say. Because you're effectively saying you need to choose one of your parents. And of course my parents had rationalized in their own way the choices that they had made, and there was no way I was going to be able to challenge them. And so I sort of took it out on her in my bar mitzvah sermon, you know, talk. And I have since grown to love her as a rabbi because she is a, you know, an amazing meditation teacher and has been somebody that I really respect. But I think that she wasn't sure how to deal with me and made a mistake that she didn't have to make. And I wonder how we prepare those clergy who will encounter this confusing situation of interfaith. Is like, people are getting better at this, right? There's like whole institutions that are set up to like deal with this issue, but there are so many other places where the multiness of our community is being confronted by a lack of training in our rabbinic leadership that needs to be fixed desperately, because little, you know, kids are the ones being impacted by all of this.
Isaac is a dad of three, and like many parents, he and Sarah are constantly trying to figure out how best to raise their kids. They chose to send their two older children, who are school-aged, to an open Orthodox Montessori Jewish day school, which obviously you could only find in Brooklyn.
So the Montessori side was better for me, and Sarah was really into the Jewish thing. And, you know, look, the language of American consumer cosmopolitanism is weak sauce. You gotta find something else. And if it happens to be that it's Jewish, and that's my family's language, my family's way of engaging that in a pluralistic setting, so be it. And I totally understand other decisions to find a way around that. And so, yeah, I mean, I from a pluralism point of view, there is some interesting stuff that goes on. The girls have to wear skirts. How long are the skirts? When do they do that? Do the teachers? All of that became like a fight, you know, for us as a family and in the Luria community. And I was really glad to be, you know, on the side of feminism in that one. And so my kids, I'm more interested in them because their lives are so Jewish. I'm more interested in them experiencing me as something other than just 100% straight up, like Jewish guy with a kippah on. And getting more out of their community than just Jewish folks, who I love, and the world is bigger than just Jews. And so getting them into exposure with others is like a key like parenting goal. I'm interested in pushing them a little bit. It's been interesting because they push us. I was just asking before this recording at family dinner, what should I say about like what it's like for you guys to be Jewish? And they were like, well, we're not really Jewish. And I'm like, what do you mean? And they're like, well, we're like 25% Egyptian gods, like we like. And we also like 25% Greek gods. And then like maybe 50% Jewish. Yeah, like 50%. Yeah. So for them, even though they have this like very Jewish life, they still are like caught up on the belief question. And like, does believing in a set of stories make you that thing? But they're so much more adept with complexity that they're sort of like, oh, I have like some interest in these different stories and these kinds of languages make sense to me. And I love that because that is how I actually think religion functions, where it's, we've created boundaries around it because it's helpful to us culturally, politically, it helps make sense of a world, and we have a racialized way of understanding peoples, right? So we do that. But faith is often just a set of stories that we become, like cultural signifiers, that we become really good at. They become our language. And I think they're like, just, we're just in a mix. And they couldn't understand anything else.
Isaac's kids may feel native enough to Judaism and therefore comfortable enough to deviate and, you know, dabble in some Egyptian and Greek mythology. But for Isaac, there's a continuing struggle to feel fully Jewish.
I desire belonging desperately because I wanted a larger community of peers when I was younger, and I didn't have that. I actually find myself to be really in relationship with the entirety of the Jewish community. Like, there are my people who are my people, but I share a story and language with the entire Jewish community, and I want to be in relationship with them. I want to speak with them. I want to build with them. And so finding my way to that, like, through the pain that I might experience in a space, is what I'm pushing on now for my own growth. But I do have a look over my shoulder, you know, about every Jewish space, especially because I'm a professional Jew who now, like, you know, speaks for the Jews sometimes. Like, I look over my shoulder about whether or not somebody's going to say, well, you're not really Jewish, you know, because your mom's a minister. I didn't go to camp. I didn't have a Jewish, like, education until I was in Israel that really, like, gave me, like, basic things like prayers and other stuff. So I'm often playing catch up. But my kids, it's just their first language.
Reverend Barbara also wanted her sons to have Judaism as their first language. And for that reason, she made sure that they both had a bar mitzvah when they reached the age of 13, even though many Jewish families no longer require that of their children.
So many Jewish families, they have told me, like, oh, my kid really didn't want to do it, and they just didn't do it. And I felt like it really is a great coming of age marker. To me, it seemed like the best opportunities for study in the city led right up to the bar mitzvah for kids. And then it was hard to become involved in a greater kind of community education. And now I know there are really great programs for teens that happen after the bar mitzvahs. But it just seemed like if we could just get there, they would have a solid enough grounding where if they chose to be Jewish for the rest of their lives, they will have had at least the foundational knowledge. There was a point where my husband, who had an Orthodox grandfather, said, oh, maybe we shouldn't drag Drew through this. You know, he doesn't really seem to be a kid who's taking to this too much. And I was like, not on my watch are we going to let a 3,000-year-old tradition like end right here. So I was the one.
Same thing happened with my mom and my dad.
Really?
Yes.
Tell us.
Well, my mom said to my dad when I was about to turn 10 that you have to give these kids bar mitzvah. There were three of us. He was like, I don't want to. And she's like, you have to. Not on my watch. So it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Now, it might seem counterintuitive for the parent who's not Jewish to be the one pushing for this Jewish coming-of-age ceremony. But the sort of dynamic that Reverend Barbara and Isaac found themselves in is one that I've heard echoed again and again in families that have a Jewish parent and a parent who's from a different tradition. To hear more stories about families like this, you can check out the Patrilineal Descent episode from last season or the episodes about my family, the Cohen family case study. In Isaac's family, the role of Jewish cheerleader, despite not being Jewish, kind of went the other way as well, with Isaac's dad becoming...
My dad became a rabbitson, but in the other way.
A rabbitson is the term for a rabbi's spouse, typically a rabbi's wife, although now it's becoming more and more common that it's a rabbi's husband as well, because thank goodness, not all rabbis are men anymore, and some men also have husbands.
He would cook the meals for events at the house. He attended every Sunday. He helped with my mom's sermons. He devoted himself to her career. Moved around a lot. We moved 4 or 5 times before I was 18. And they all knew he was like the Jewish guy. So faith is like an institution, but also my family business. And now I'm sort of in it. So something caught. I'm not sure what. And still trying to figure that out.
Much of Barbara's journey has also been about trying to determine the role of faith in her life, from her Christian upbringing to choosing to raise a Jewish family, and finally, deciding to become an interfaith minister.
I'm like kind of rogue. I'm a spiritual rebel. Like I can't really be any one thing. I think I'm just hardwired that way. I met my husband on the Jersey Shore, just hanging out on the beach one day. I fell in love with him really quickly and was really convinced that he was the person I was going to marry. And we woke up one morning and he was like, I don't know what to do, because I always thought I would have a Jewish family. You know, we were both crying and he was like, why don't you learn something about Judaism? And I was like, well, why don't you learn something about Judaism? Because I don't think you know that much about it either. So we ended up taking a 9-month program with a rabbi who was guiding couples through mainly the conversion process. Somebody was going to be converting to Judaism in those couples. And I wasn't there, but I was willing to go and learn everything I can. And in that class, I just discovered the beauty of the Jewish religion, and I knew that I could raise a Jewish family. Like, I knew that completely. And becoming a minister was a sort of a midlife career change for me in a lot of ways. I decided that I was going to go educate myself by going to seminary, an interfaith seminary, this sort of wild, wonderful experience at a place called One Spirit in New York City. And so I got to study the world's major religious traditions and also indigenous wisdom traditions from around the world, and I'm still in a place where I can't just choose one. And I was really moved by some of the statistics recently from the Pew Center on Religion Research in the United States. 4 in 10 people at this point will marry somebody outside of their religious group. So in a way, we are pioneers trying to explore what faith and religion mean in our own lives. So I think this is such a vital part of the conversation in the United States. This is a conversation we can't not have, you know, how to think about faith and families and where we all go personally with the decisions we make.
Although the need for conversations like this has grown in intensity as the number of children born of interfaith marriage has increased over the last few decades, it's not entirely new. And it so happens that Reverend Barbara's senior minister at Judson Memorial Church wrote a book about raising children in two traditions all the way back in the 90s. I was able to sit down with her for a few minutes to have her explain.
So I'm Donna Scopper, and I'm the senior minister at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. And I've been here for 14 years, and I've been doing the work of parish ministry, public ministry, and community organization for 42 years. And I have lived to tell the tales of it. I did write a book called Raising Interfaith Children, subtitled Spiritual Orphans or Spiritual Heirs. And I argued that they are spiritual heirs to something new and revelatory and different that is coming. So that book I did in like 1996, really as a way to understand what was going on. I tried to be very honest about the problems as well as the wonder of it. Obviously, I think the wonder far exceeds the problems, but there are problems.
Reverend Donna was able to write this book because of her experience raising 3 children as Christians and Jews.
I did marry Warren Goldstein, and I thought, well, that was a great career as a Christian minister, and I guess I have to give it up because I'm in love with this guy. I tried to get out of love with him and moved away, and he followed me, and then we got married. And I was so wrong about how congregations were going to receive me. They actually like Warren more than they like me. And they like the fact that my faith is unapologetically Christian, but that I am not interested in everybody else being who I am, that I like other people and have utter respect for anyone's spiritual search for the divine. Warren was a cultural Jew. He really hated religion. He didn't understand me. He certainly didn't understand why I was doing what I was doing with my life. And so He said, I don't care. They can be Christians for all I care. And I said, oh no, that's not going to happen. So we made a deal that for the younger part of their lives, they would come to Sunday school and church with me. So the poor kids lived at church. They came to church after school. They were in Sunday school all the time. They really had what I would call a nice cradle in Christianity. Learned the stories, learned the Bible, have the soft, fuzzy feelings of little kids. And then when they were 8, the deal was, now they will go to Hebrew school. And poor Warren had to find a Hebrew school, and everywhere he went, he hated Hebrew school again. And he really shopped it, and part of the reason we moved to Amherst, Massachusetts, was that there was a more simpatico temple there. And next thing I know, he's kind of become a religious Jew.
And one more thing you should know about Reverend Donna. In addition to being Barbara's boss at Judson.
And so I'm also the mother of Isaac Luria, who's married to a rabbi, Sarah Luria. Katie Goldstein, who's married to a wonderfully, very pregnant woman right now. And Jacob Luria. I have seen once Isaac's t-shirt that he wears around Brooklyn. My mom's a minister, my wife's a rabbi, get over it. And so that's, I guess, how I feel about it.
I can't wait for an opportunity to interview both Reverend Donna and Warren Goldstein next year in a future episode. This is just a tiny taste of the stories that they have to tell about their interfaith pioneering in the 80s. But I did want to know from Isaac, raised in a dual-faith home and now raising his own kids in a Jewish home, what does the future of religion look like? It's just a guess. Obviously, we'll check back in 30 years and see if he's right.
Far-right conservative religion appears to be maintaining its hold. That is going to remain a very powerful force in our society. While progressive religion is going to have a moment of sort of anti-institutional fervor, is going to be very open to new ways of interpreting itself and have a great convergence sort of theologically, so that more and more the progressive side of religions writ large in America will look more and more the same in the way that their conversation is happening, maybe with different languages, different traditions, articulating similar things. And that conversation, what happens, it does it become like a unitary sort of experience, like a new religion? I don't think we know, but I sort of hope not, because I would rather it be a deeply democratic and rich conversation between people who are extraordinarily deep in their own traditions.
There's an amazing example of this that took place just after the shooting in Pittsburgh at a synagogue in October.
We were having a service at Judson where Isaac's mom was delivering the sermon, and it was his dad who stood up and came to the microphone at the front of the church and invited everyone who had an interfaith family or any connection to Judaism to come forward, and he recited the Mourner's Kaddish. So, yeah. I mean, it was just extraordinarily beautiful how he really led the service in so many ways.
And maybe this is exactly what we have to look forward to in this country. The raising up of traditions that come from different religious places and different faith structures, but that acknowledge the ways in which all of us are no longer born to our faiths, but cross into them and out of them by who we marry, by how we're raised, and by our own choices. Rabbi Deborah Waxman, the president of Reconstructing Judaism, talks about today as an era in which we are engaged in Judaism by consent rather than Judaism by descent. And that, to me, is an era bursting with possibility. Deep thanks to Reverend Barbara Becker, Isaac Luria, and Reverend Donna Scopper for being on this episode. I'm also very excited to thank, for the first time, Beloved for offering us space to record this episode. As always, I'm happy to hear from you. You can reach out over email at jutupodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter at jutupodcast. You can also support the podcast financially at jutupodcast.com, where you'll also find episode show notes, a guide to previous episodes, and additional info about the podcast. We'll be back sometime this summer with another episode and a full roster next fall. Till then, this is Jutu, Tales of the Mixed Multitude.